May it please the Court, Diana Wattrell on behalf of Appellant Raymond Martin. This case is about the Sixth Amendment right to a trial by an impartial jury. On the second day of trial in this case, the wife of Mr. Martin's co-conspirator gained unauthorized access to the jury room. The district court undertook a Remmer investigation to determine the facts of the encounter, but its investigation fell short of the requirements set forth by the Supreme Court in Remmer versus United States. The district court committed three reversible errors. First, the district court did not adequately determine whether the jurors remained impartial after their contact with the woman in the jury room. Remmer requires a district court to conduct a three-step process, including an inquiry into jury prejudice. Although the court asked the jurors about the facts of the incident, the court did not ask jurors whether they could put these facts behind them and remain unbiased. Second, the district court failed to remedy legal prejudice that resulted from the woman's presence in the jury room. Once a court undertakes a Remmer hearing, the government bears the burden of demonstrating that the contact with the jury was harmless to the defendant. The government did not meet its burden in this case, which meant that the jury contact became conclusively prejudicial. The district court erred by allowing a biased jury to decide Mr. Martin's guilt.
You know, to the extent that your structural error claim rests on the assumption that a seated juror was biased as a result of the encounter in the jury room, where is your support for that contention? I mean, how can a statement that a juror was scared to find a non-juror in the jury room lead to a finding that that juror was actually biased? I don't understand.
Sure. In this case, we have in the record a juror stating that it was a little scared. The burden here is on the government to show that there was no prejudice or that Mr. Martin was not biased by the incident. We don't have a record here showing anything beyond that. And to the extent that there is speculation, that risk falls on the government. It does not fall on the defendant.
There was no need to proceed to that step. And here's the reason why. In other words, to determine, you know, whether contact was prejudicial, because the court had concluded that there'd been no communication, no contact had occurred.
Well, in this case, there had been no communication. I agree to that. The problem, though, is that there can be jury bias apart from communication. In this case, CM, who was in the jury room, was associated with the case. Her husband was a co-conspirator. She was in the jury room. This is not a chance encounter with someone who happens to be in the elevator and passes by a jury member. This was someone who was involved in the case, who was present in the jury room. The fact that she was in the jury room in a case that involved charges of witness tampering, my client was charged with trying to kill two witnesses who were testifying against him. The jurors could put two and two together and become scared based on that, and we have a statement.
Whether it takes place in an elevator or it takes place in a room, in both cases, wouldn't it be dispositive that there was, in fact, no communication with a juror about a matter that's pending before the jury? There was no communication.
Well, there is precedent from other circuits that something beyond a communication can give rise to prejudice. In United States versus Sintop, which is a case from the Ninth Circuit, there was a defendant who was eyeballing a juror, and the court remanded the Court of Appeals remanded to the district court to find out whether there was prejudice.
And in that situation, the juror, of course, knew who the defendant was, right? So had a reason to be scared.
That's right. In this case, we just don't have a record as to whether the jurors knew who the woman was or not. Additionally, there are charges of witness tampering. And so even if the jurors were not aware of the association, they would still recognize that there was someone in the jury room who was not supposed to be in the jury room.
Right. But what indication is there? Why would the jurors have concluded that this person who was in the jury room for 5 minutes and didn't say anything had any connection with the case?
She was in the courtroom the day before for opening arguments, and she was taking notes that day. She then, after the incident, was allowed to sit in the jury room, to sit in the courtroom for the rest of the day. She was also taking notes. One of the jurors specifically noted that he saw her sitting in the courtroom for the rest of the day.
Maybe she was a journalist. Maybe she was kind of a court rat who goes around and keeps track of trials.
It's possible. And at this point, we just don't know. The court didn't create a record for that, and you know, we just have to speculate at this point as to that. And the speculation would fall to the burden of the government, not to the defendant.
Well, we have a transcript of all the interviews of the jurors, correct?
That's right.
Did any of the jurors say, hey, ask the judge, you know, I'm concerned that this person might have a connection with the case?
The jurors did not say that. They did not. Although the court did not ask jurors if they had that concern, and the judge did not ask jurors if they could put the incident behind them either.
Right, but if the judge had asked the jurors whether they were concerned that this person had a connection with the case, wouldn't have that put something in the jurors' minds and created a problem where there otherwise wouldn't have been?
Yes, that's exactly right, and I think that's the point as to why the Supreme Court requires all three steps. Once a court embarks on the process of a Remmer hearing, it does plant an idea in the juror's mind, and this court recognized that idea in United States v. Blitch when it recognized that district courts do have discretion when they're deciding whether or not to conduct a Remmer hearing, because starting a Remmer hearing can create an impression on the jurors. So at the point when the district court does start to conduct a Remmer hearing, it needs to take all three steps to ensure that the jurors are not biased or are not impacted even by the district court's holding of the Remmer hearing itself.
You know, I want to talk to you about Harbin, because you cited it for the proposition that the jury incident constituted structural error. But Harbin explicitly recognizes that jury tampering is not a structural error, but rather is a trial error that is presumptively but not conclusively prejudicial. So.
Sure. My reading of Harbin is that there's a spectrum of errors. There are structural errors on one end of the spectrum, and there are trial errors on the other. Harbin would say that there are structural errors, and right next to structural errors are errors that are presumptively prejudicial. In this case, the government did not overcome its burden, and so by not overcoming its burden, the error changed from presumptively prejudicial to conclusively prejudicial.
That's what you think Harbin says?
That's my reading of it, Your Honor.
Okay. Guess what? The author has a different reading. Thank you.
Thank you. If Your Honor doesn't have any more questions, that'll be all for me. Thank you.
You want to come up here?
I think it might be.
Oh, I'm sorry. What am I doing? I'm keeping you from your...
For a moment, I didn't know if the red light was... It was all over and not...
Okay.
May it please the Court, my name is Christopher Catazone for Appellant Raymond Martin. Your Honor, should the court deny a request for a new trial, we ask in the alternative that the court remand to the district court for resentencing. There's no dispute in this case that the pre-sentence report incorrectly calculated the sentencing guidelines range for Mr. Martin. The government says, however, that we cannot show that this was prejudicial to Mr. Martin because the district court was going to impose a life sentence upon him in any case. The record does not support this contention. As we point out in our briefs, the district court repeatedly stated that it was applying a guidelines range sentence. It began the sentencing by explicitly adopting the findings of the pre-sentence report. It echoed the pre-sentence report's statements that the guidelines range was 5 years to life on count 4 and 25 years to life on count 5. It sentenced Mr. Martin precisely within these guidelines ranges. And after sentencing, in the statement of reasons filed by the district court, it checked the box next to the statement that it, quote, adopts the pre-sentence investigation report without change, end quote, and also indicated, quote, that Mr. Martin's sentence was within an advisory guidelines range and that the court sentences the defendant to the high end of the guidelines. The government seeks to get around these facts with several arguments, but none of them succeed. The first is that the district court's harsh words to Mr. Martin at sentencing somehow overcame the district court's repeated statements that it was, in fact, applying a guidelines range sentence. But the government cites no case to suggest that harsh words would overcome the words and actions of the court stating that it was applying a guidelines range sentence. Further, the district court's statements make sense in the context of any long sentence that was in contemplation here, whether it be 30 years, 40 years, or life. And third, when the district court seeks to impose a life sentence regardless of the guidelines range, it knows how to do so. It knows how to say, I believe that life sentence is the proper sentence regardless of what guidelines range applies here. And the district court simply did not say that. The government also points out that the district court rejected Mr. Martin's request for a lower sentence, a less than life sentence. But Mr. Martin made this request explicitly noting that it was a request for an out-of-guideline sentence, not a within-guidelines, less-than-life sentence. And further, the district court also rejected the government's request for an above-guideline sentence. These facts also support the idea that this was a within-guideline sentence. In short, there's only one person who knows whether or not this would have been a life sentence, and that is the district court. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you so much. Okay, now, Mr. Cutchin.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. My name is Jim Cutchin, and I do represent the United States in this case.
Can we start with the last issue first, please?
Certainly.
Because I don't see how we can possibly affirm the sentence here when the court made it clear that it was imposing a within-guideline sentence, and it was mistaken as to what sentence the guidelines called for. Why don't you just concede that?
Well, Your Honor, I guess I don't agree with the court. I don't think it's that clear.
What part of it? Are you saying that the probation office's guidelines calculation was correct?
Your Honor, I'm saying that
yes or no. Was the guidelines calculation correct in the PSR?
Under a pre-Booker, no. Under post-Booker, I think there's an argument that it was.
So you're saying that the probation office correctly determined that the guidelines range was 5 years to life and 25 years to life on those two counts?
I think the guidelines authorized a sentence of up to life under 2K2.4B plus the application note. And this court has said that post-Booker, that the concepts of departures, which application note 2 refers to, are obsolete, as well as the district courts need to give notice. But
look.
Aside from that.
No, aside from nothing. Given that a life sentence was a possibility for the witness tampering count as well, but was outside the guideline range, and the court chose not to impose the life sentence, how can we say in this appeal that the sentencing court would have chosen the life sentence for counts 4 and 5 had it known the guidelines recommendation?
Your Honor, I think from the comments of the district court, it's clear that the district court intended to impose a life sentence in this case. It chose to do so in what it thought was the most procedurally or appeal-proof, I guess, to use a term, way that it did that. It had a guideline range in the PSR on counts 4 and 5 that indicated that it was appropriate under the guidelines to go up to life. Okay. It chose to do because it knew, the district court's very well aware, this court would presume that a sentence within the guideline range on those counts, if that were correct, would be reasonable. It makes perfect sense for a district court to do that. The comments of the district court make clear that he intended that Raymond Martin would never get out of jail.
Yeah, but the court clearly wanted to impose a significant sentence. I will certainly give you that. But there isn't a way in the world to know whether that would have been 30 years, a higher number of years, or life. There just isn't.
Well, Your Honor, having been present in the courtroom, I disagree, but I certainly respect that the court...
I'm never present in the courtroom.
I understand.
I can't be present in the courtroom, but I sure can look at the record.
I understand. At most, I think what this court should do would be a Palladino-type remand, where it simply asks the district court, would you impose the same sentence, absent the alleged guideline error, which was not objected to by the defendant? That's a simple question that it could ask. There's no reason for this court to remand the entire case for an entire new sentencing back to the district court, when I think the record would indicate at least there is a strong indication that the district court would impose the same sentence.
Guess what? We do not decide cases on strong indications.
I understand, Your Honor.
Okay. Go to your other issue.
Your Honor, with regard to the jury tampering issue, I think the court is exactly right when it says that The investigation the district court undertook revealed that there was no improper contact. Under this court's decisions in Moore, which coincidentally was also a case arising in Benton involving Judge Gilbert, in that case a defendant, an associate of the defendant encountered a juror during lunch in a restaurant and wouldn't move out of the way as the juror tried to leave. The juror comes back, tells another juror about this incident. The district court undertook a similar type of inquiry as it did here. It brought in that juror plus the five other jurors, I think it was, that she talked to, and determined there was no prejudice. On appeal, and in that case, unlike in this case, Moore actually moved for a mistrial and preserved that issue, which I guess I should say at the outset, I believe that the defendant has entirely waived this issue by failing to object and specifically acquiescing to the procedures that the district court employed in this case. But in Moore, this court said, here the court chose to conduct a formalized inquiry, even though juror I's interaction with Moore's associate, where no words, gestures, materials were exchanged, is not the type that necessarily raises a presumption of prejudice. In this case, while the district court engaged in a Rimmer-type inquiry, it was not required to do so under Rimmer. So all the things that the appellant says that the district court was required to do and failed to do, those simply don't apply in this case.
You said a Rimmer-type hearing. Was it a Rimmer hearing, or was it kind of a pre-Rimmer hearing to see whether he needed a Rimmer hearing?
I agree, Your Honor. That's exactly what I think the district court did. He was trying to discover exactly what happened, which is logically the first step that you would do. Is there something that's going to require the court to do more? And he found that it did not.
Did Judge Gilbert at any point make it clear to the jurors that the non-juror was inadvertently taken to the jury room?
He did several times throughout the transcript of the individual voir dire, the sealed transcript. The judge told the jurors that it was, he didn't tell every single one of them, but several of them, most of them he did, that this was just simply a screw-up on the part of the CSOs. And several of the jurors, as we cited in the government's brief, indicated to the court, it was clear that she was in a place where she wasn't supposed to be. She knew she wasn't supposed to be there. We knew she wasn't supposed to be there. And it was an odd situation that when everyone figured out what exactly had happened, it was simply not a big deal. There was nothing about that that carried over to the defendant or that any juror would think was the defendant's fault. Your Honors, for all the reasons we ask that you affirm both the judgments and the sentence of the district court.
Woo, woo, woo. Okay, thank you. You were doing real well until that last clause. All right, come on up.
Just briefly, Your Honor. On page 33 of the government's brief, they expressly concede that the district court rightfully conducted a Rimmer hearing. A Rimmer hearing was required in the first instance in this case. As I discussed earlier, CM was involved in this case. Her husband was involved in the case. And so the district court did rightfully start to conduct a Rimmer hearing. Our position is that...
You did hear Mr. Cutchin. And what he said was absolutely correct. Mr. Martin agreed to the procedures that were used by the court, did not object to continuing with the jury.
It doesn't. This is a case of forfeiture, not a case of waiver. Mr. Martin did not intentionally relinquish his rights in this case. He was not present during the questioning of the jurors. He did not see a transcript of the questioning of the jurors. His counsel talked to him afterwards and before they questioned the woman, and his attorney was present for the questioning of the woman. So any questioning of the woman itself would be waived, but not of the jurors. And that's what we're contesting here, is the questioning of the jurors.
Where in the government's brief does it admit that a Rimmer hearing took place?
Page 33. Let's give you one. The government says, to be sure, there was initial concern.
Right.
On 33, in the first full paragraph at the bottom. The government says, to be sure, there was initial concern on the part of the parties because of who CM was married to, and the district court rightly and in abundance of caution opted to conduct an inquiry to ensure that nothing proper had occurred.
Right, but could that have been a pre-Rimmer inquiry to see whether further investigation was required?
Well, I believe that by determining what occurred, that was conducting a Remmer hearing. The district court embarked on a Remmer procedure by first determining what occurred. That's the first step of Remmer, and that's what the court is doing.
And that even if the district court concludes that nothing at all bad happened and there was no contact and no communication, it still then has to go on to steps 2 and 3?
Not necessarily. I would say there would be some circumstances where the district court would not be required to go on to steps 2 and 3, but this is not one of those cases.
And why not?
An example of where the district court would not have to go on to steps 2 and 3 would be a case where there was a woman in the jury room and no one saw the woman in the jury room. Or, for example, if there was someone walking around the parking lot with a gun and none of the jurors saw that person. If the judge simply said, "What happened today?" and the jurors said, "I showed up to court, nothing happened today," then there would be no reason to go to steps 2 and 3. But because the jurors knew that something was amiss in the courtroom, the judge needed to go to steps 2 and 3 and make sure that the jurors were not biased.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Case is taken under advisement.